St. Thomas Aquinas wrote, "Because philosophy arises from awe, a philosopher is bound in his way to be a lover of myths and poetic fables. Poets and philosophers are alike in being big with wonder." This is the After Dinner Scholar podcast from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Last week on the After Dinner Scholar, I interviewed Dr. Paul Giesting, newly arrived professor of mathematics and science. Today I have the privilege of introducing to you philosopher Dr. Daniel Shields. Dr. Shields did his undergraduate work at Thomas Aquinas College and received his PhD from the Catholic University of America. His main interest is in the philosophy of nature and science, ethics, moral psychology, and medieval philosophy. Before coming to Wyoming Catholic College, but wait, perhaps I should let him tell his own story.
I grew up in Southern California. My father teaches at Thomas Aquinas College and has for he does one more year, it'll be 50 years.
Wow.
So we grew up as part of that community. I was homeschooled and then attended Thomas Aquinas College. Went on to graduate school at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., in the School of Philosophy. Earned my master's degree and PhD there. And moved to Cleveland. Ended up marrying another TAC alumna from the Cleveland area. Then I taught for a couple of years at Xavier University in Cincinnati, and then taught for 7 years at the Josephinum, which is a seminary in Columbus, Ohio. And now we've come here.
Great, great. And you're married, you have?
Four kids, four boys.
Four. Mm-hmm. I guess this question has already kind of been answered. You attended Thomas Aquinas and went on for a PhD in philosophy. What are your primary interests in philosophy, and how did you get onto those things?
My primary interests are philosophy of nature and science and ethics. And I got on to the former topic, which has become my primary interest, by means of the later topic. And thinking about ethics for many years, I did my dissertation on moral philosophy and thought about the church's teaching on contraception and Aquinas' theory of natural law. And it became clear to me that I couldn't make sense of how that worked without an understanding of nature as being not meaningless raw material, as it's often looked at in our contemporary world and by the sciences, but as intrinsically meaningful, or to be more, use philosophical terminology, that nature is teleological or intrinsically purposive. And that shifted my interest towards philosophy of nature to try to defend that understanding.
You know, you've done a great deal of work on St. Thomas Aquinas, and many people hear his name and think not about philosophy, but about theology. How is Thomas a philosopher, or perhaps what does a philosopher take from Thomas?
Yeah, so St. Thomas Aquinas taught and worked, lived in medieval university systems. And much like modern seminaries and the medieval universities, nobody was even allowed to study theology until they had completed their course of studies in the arts and especially in philosophy. So although he's primarily a theologian, he is a fully trained philosopher. And in the Middle Ages, the other philosophers, those who were purely philosophers and not theologians, they had a special interest in St. Thomas Aquinas' works because they recognized how his philosophical acumen. Right? So he is primarily a theologian, but he's about as good of a philosopher as one can get and recognized as such by other philosophers. And he spends a lot of time giving arguments for the various positions that he considers that are not only based on the authority of scripture or the church's tradition, the church's teaching, but arguments that are based on premises that one can know without revelation. Right? There are certainly things that he covers that you can't do that for, such as Trinitarian theology and Christology and things like that. But in so much of his work, he provides philosophical reasons in addition to scriptural evidence for the positions that he takes. So there's plenty for philosophers to find in his works.
You know, I went to a very, very good evangelical seminary, and nobody ever taught any philosophy. And even at the time, I kind of thought, that's odd. And the more I go on, the more I realize it's not only odd, it's a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. Because you come to the theology and you can have all the good Bible study if you want, but if the underlying philosophy is bad, bad things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things that the church has been very wise about, is in teaching seminarians philosophy before they teach them theology. And one of the reasons that the church gives in its documents for this is that otherwise the theology will not be received properly. And in particular, in today's culture, without an adequate philosophical background, they will be the seminarians would be inclined to take theology in a relative sense, right? This is true for us. It's not an absolute truth. It's not true for everyone. It's not true in itself. This is what we believe. And relativizing theology destroys what we're all about.
Now, speaking of Thomas, you have a book that's at the publishers even as we speak. Mm-hmm. Nature and Nature's God, the Scientific and Philosophical Validity of Thomas's Proof of an Unmoved Mover. Tell us about your book.
Yeah, so it's about Aquinas's most famous proof for God's existence, the proof that begins with motion and arrives at the conclusion that an unmoved mover exists, and he says that this unmoved mover is God. This is the first of the famous five ways in the Summa Theologiae. That argument is often criticized by contemporaries as hopelessly out of sync with modern science, right? When people think of motion, they think of physics, and it seems to be in conflict with, for example, the principle of inertia, that things can just move on their own, continue moving on their own without anything pushing them around. And so the critics of the argument often just dismiss it as being hopelessly out of sync with modern science.
Well, isn't it also critiqued because you've got to stop and say, all right, God's the unmoved mover. Mm-hmm. Well, isn't the critique also, well, no, the universe is, in a sense, the unmoved mover.
Uh-huh.
The universe always was. It's all there ever was. Isn't that part of the critique?
Yeah, and that can be the criticism at times too, yes. Sometimes people say, well, it's not valid. The argument's not valid at all. And other people will say, no, well, the argument's valid, understood in a certain way, but it only gets you to a conclusion that's nothing like what we want to call God. Yeah, so that happens quite a bit as well. The defenders of the argument have tended to say, to want to fence it off from modern science and say modern science just doesn't matter because this is not a scientific argument, it's a metaphysical argument. And as a metaphysical argument, it's just exempt from considerations of the sciences. Although there's a lot of people who have defended the argument have done a lot of good work, I think that strategy is somewhat of a mistake, that it's not a scientific argument. It's certainly true. It's a philosophical argument. But I don't think it's a metaphysical argument either. There's a discipline of philosophy, a traditionally understood discipline called natural philosophy or philosophy of nature. And I believe that the argument is a philosophy of nature argument. And in order to defend the argument as a philosophy of nature argument, I think that modern science is very much relevant. And so I spend the first half of the book trying to understand the argument in its medieval context with a medieval understanding of physics. And then in the second part of the book, say, okay, what really has changed in modern physics? And this, how do we understand the argument? How do we modify it so as to integrate it with modern science? And I claim that there's actually surprisingly little that you have to modify, but you do have to modify a little bit. And then the argument works very well in the context of modern science.
Now, that won't be where our freshmen are starting their philosophy careers. What will you be teaching starting, my goodness, a week from tomorrow?
Yes, so I'll be teaching logic to the freshmen and ethics to the juniors. So in logic, we use much of Aristotle's Organon, right? The categories, on interpretation, a little bit of the prior analytics and posterior analytics. So Aristotle's logical works. And then we work through an Aristotelian understanding of the syllogism and kind of the middle section of the course. But we also start with Plato. So we read the Alcibiades, the Meno, and the Cratylus. So, but the most of the semester is Aristotle.
Thomas wrote, "Because philosophy arises from awe, a philosopher is bound in his way to be a lover of myths and poetic fables. Mm-hmm. Poets and philosophers are alike in being big with wonder." Can you comment about that?
Certainly, a philosopher has to be full of wonder. Right? One can't understand the answers to any philosophical questions until the questions themselves have come alive. Right? One needs the question before the answer. So a philosopher has to have a desire to understand. That desire has to be awakened. And that involves also understanding the limits of what one already knows. Right? If something seems very familiar, our mind does not become very active with it. It seems not to merit our attention or focus or energy. Right? So we have to become aware of the limitations of what we know and then become desirous of knowing better if we're going to learn anything. But human beings are not angels, right? We're not disembodied intellects, right? We're very much embodied, right? So our way of understanding things always involves the imagination, no matter what. Even if in mathematics, we end up having these little diagrams in our minds or what have you, the little symbols.
We have imaginary numbers.
Yeah, that's right. In order to understand, we always have to have the right kind of images. Our minds have to be stocked with the right kind of, not just visual images, but auditory images and every kind of sensory image. And those images need, in order to become desirous of learning and to have an energy and a desire to understand these things, right? We have to have images that kind of evoke that desire for wisdom. It's poetry and literature and song and also images of the natural world that poetry draws on, right, that evoke that wonder, such as seeing the stars in the sky and the Milky Way, right? One just wants to know, the beauty of the sight draws one, and one wants to know, what is that up there? Why does it move the way it moves, right? What's the source of this all? Where did it come from, right? And those sorts of experiences, poetic experiences, awaken the desire to know that we have to have in order to know.
Sounds like a Wyoming Catholic college education.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thomas Aquinas wrote, "The study of philosophy is not that we may know what men have thought, but what the truth of things is." For our freshmen, and certainly not only our freshmen, 21 days in the backcountry is an education on what the truth of things is. Under the careful tutelage of our faculty, including Dr. Daniel Shields, they'll continue to grow this year in their understanding of the truth of things in a world and in a culture that seeks to deny that there is a truth of things. It is an education for which they and we should be deeply grateful. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.